Hello and welcome to a special edition of Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce, driven by US President Donald Trump's wild charge at South Africa for what he called confiscating land. South Africa, he tweeted on Sunday, is confiscating land and treating certain classes of people very badly, said in capital letters. It's a bad situation that the radical left media doesn't want so much to mention. A massive human rights violation, at a minimum, is happening for all to see. The United States won't stand for it. We will act. Also, I will be cutting off all future funding to South Africa until a full investigation of this situation has been completed. So, cue one of the fiercest rounds of online infighting between South Africans of every political persuasion that I can remember in a long time. Both left and right seemed to blame AfriForum. AfriForum cried foul and said Trump had got it wrong and he should be sanctioning governing politicians, not everybody else. Then everyone piled in and said, well, you got what you deserved and now you're in the dwang. You try to bring upon your opponents. Blacks blamed whites and whites ducked and dived. There was a depressing amount of support for Trump. I'm very pleased this afternoon to have former DA leader Tony Leon here to talk to me about it. And Tony, amid all the screeching since Trump made his remark on Sunday, I reckon it would be hard to find anyone in more trouble by the end of Monday than current DA leader John Steenhuisen. He'd spent months denouncing the Expropriation Act that Trump was referring to in the comments on social media about South Africa. Just last week, he was tweeting that the DA, quote, will not stand by as the ANC undermines the GNU to push through policies that threaten your property, healthcare, and the economy. The party is challenging these within the GNU and taking legal action against the unconstitutional Expropriation Act. On Monday, after the world's most powerful and its richest man had taken a stand against what they think the expropriation bill does, and suddenly there was the DA leader loudly defending what he had only so recently denounced. It's not true that the act allows land to be seized by the state arbitrarily, he said, and it does require fair compensation for legitimate expropriations. It would be a tragedy if this funding, i.e. the money that Trump now threatens to withdraw, were terminated because of a misunderstanding of the facts. Tony, can a DA leader do this and survive?
I don't have any say in the continuance of this or any other DA leader. It's a very awkward position the DA finds itself in. They've obviously, the original trigger happened in Parliament when this was enacted, I think as recently as early last year, finally through the NCOP. And the DA was the party that pointed out that this Expropriation Act, then a bill, undermined security of tenure and property title. Now, of course, they were shortchanged by Cyril Ramaphosa in the signing of it, in the sense they got no notice. Their input, apparently Dean McPherson sent a very rigorous legal opinion to Cyril Ramaphosa, which was ignored, and McPherson wasn't even done the courtesy of an advance notice that the legislation was to be passed. So the pirouettes to Monday is, as you say, difficult. And it's difficult to explain. I understand why the DA is doing this, because I think they're very anxious that the Expropriation Act doesn't actually become the worst part of it that it could be. In other words, the more they bang the drum to say there's no expropriation without compensation here, the easier it will be for them to later criticize or even call out or even oppose if, in fact, that's what happens under the framework of this act. But this is a very complex position to explain, as you know. And as the old adage goes, when you're explaining, you're losing. So, they are being killed on social media. I don't know how much Twitter, other than when Trump makes a tweet, which, of course, brings a whole syndrome with it, as we know, actually matters. I think what will matter is what will actually happen now that this act is operationalized, and will, in fact, Cyril Ramaphosa consider amendments to it, which apparently he's intimated he will do, to make it less worse than it currently is. And the real problem with this act is actually not that it allows for wholesale land grabs. It introduces in legislation, for the first time in this country's history, the concept of mill compensation. That's not written in the Constitution. It wasn't in the previous legislation. It's in this bill. And that sets the hairs running because people say, well, once you start with this concept, it's a green light to a whole lot of other things that could derail property ownership in this country. And I think that's the essential problem. Now, look, it's early days. I want to give the best interpretation of it. But happily, I don't have to explain how we arrived at this point because I'm not in the government. So I'm not heading the DA. But I hope that they can at least clarify, and I think they've tried to do that, why they've taken the position they have, given, as you say, that and very recently they were going to court on this. Maybe they still are going to court. I simply don't know.
You know, there's no way. I can't think what I would have done. I mean, they're doing it because they have to, you know, they don't want to, you know, no, there's no point in blowing up the government of national unity over it. But there is a point in not getting yourself into such a mess if you're the leader of a party. But having said that, I don't know how I would have gotten out of this myself. I mean, I don't want to ask you what you would have done, but I mean, what could he have done better than what he did do?
Look, that's a very good question. And I understand what they call the meta-narrative here, is that however grudgingly the ANC respects or disrespects property rights and however vehemently the DA supports them, which I think is the correct characterization of both, if the DA were to leave the government or blow it up, then the entrance of the EFF-MK into government would assure us that it would not just be a possibility of an expropriation or compensation, but a racing certainty that that would come to pass in one form or another. So they are trying to avert the greater evil. But as you say, I think the problem, and I mentioned this in an interview I did on a television show, JJ Tabani, last night, is that John Steenhuisen, not because he lacks the willingness to have it, but it depends on the other party, has very insufficient face time with Cyril Ramaphosa. I think they've only met one-on-one two or three times since this government was formed 7 months ago. That is an untenable situation in terms of having a joined-up government. And more untenable, frankly, is for Cyril Ramaphosa to go overseas and parade this government of national unity and say what good Democrats we are, whereas he comes home and carries on, as the signing of this act indicated, as though he heads one-party government when he heads a 10-party government. But he behaves at home, not overseas, as someone who is solely in charge. And actually, to quote one of his pompous phrases when he signed during the furious correspondence, he has tempered his prerogatives to behave simply as a chief executive who's not answerable to anyone other than his party.
Yeah. Does he have the ability, you're a lawyer, you probably know, does he have the ability to change the law now that he signed it into?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's very easy. He can do that with you can have a 3 or 4 line amendment bill to any act. And this is an enacted piece of legislation. You simply introduce an amendment, okay, amending bill.
But it's got to go through Parliament again. DA voters, I don't want to labour this particular point. I mean, they'll be a bit unsettled by what they've seen, surely. I mean, last week was one story and this week it's another one.
No, it's very hard. And they've got a communications issue to resolve, and I hope they resolve it because, you know, I'm not one of these gloomsters who wants this whole thing to blow up. I mean, the alternative is far worse.
Let's just talk quickly about the alternative. Is it just a given, do you think, that both EFF and the MK would join the ANC? I mean, Cyril would lose his head, surely. I mean, the whole reason for forming the MK was to get rid of him.
No, absolutely. Very difficult. The EFF is far more transactional than the MK. Well, I don't know what the MK is. It seems to be, you know, whatever. Yeah. Zuma wakes up in the morning deciding who will be in it and what they'll do on a given day. But as we know, because actually they had a meeting and there was a 3-page letter which eventuated in the middle of June from the EFF when they tried to get into the government, they are prepared to enter the government without condition, they say, even in respect for the Constitution, provided the DA and the EFF is not in that government. That was the only condition. Now, they might have adjusted. They've also changed positions with rapidity. But so the EFF can come in without the MKs. I'm sure they'd happily do. They're just grasping for both positions and relevance at the moment. And then, you know, Cyril would basically have, you know, 50%. Well, he'd have probably more than that because he's got all these other minnow parties who would probably stay in. So he'd easily clear the 50% threshold. And then the other option, which I think we've discussed before, but it is a real option, is the ANC could continue as a 40 or 43% party with 3% additions from these minor parties, absent the DA, the EFF, and the MK. And they can take their chances on budget day that they can get a budget through. But that is a chance. It's not a – and obviously any of these permutations we've just discussed will do horrific damage to the economy, to the currency, to the bond market, as you well know, better than most. So it's not that any of these are cost-free exercises.
Yeah. So did just last question about the negotiations for the GNU – did anybody sort of practice run? I know it was very quick. You had no time. But did you envisage, and was there a discussion, and was there a decision about what to do in a situation just like this, where you were forced, or the DA was going to be forced to defend laws that it fundamentally opposes?
Well, I think we thought, might have been a naive assumption, might have been a bad faith assumption, bad faith on the ANC making it so. So I don't want to sound like a choir boy here, that the provision in the statement of intent, which required the new government, when after its formation, to immediately have a strategy cabinet lehotla to determine the policy of the government going forward, would allow a party like the DA to note, deal with, and have its objections to current policies addressed. Yeah. It wasn't made more explicit than that. Maybe we should have had an annexure saying these items of legislation are entirely unacceptable. I need to say, and it's not something I would have done, but Helen Ziller did it, that Helen, during the negotiations, made it absolutely clear to the ANC, not on the EWC or not on the expropriation bill, which hadn't been signed, but on Bella, which also hadn't been signed, that for the DA it was a thick red line. So the ANC took the calculation, I think, that they could go into a government with the DA and they would just take their chances that the DA wouldn't blow it up, even if the DA's red lines were crossed. Now, many governments and many parties and presidents in the world have red lines that get crossed, and they continue. But I think there's only so much one-way traffic, just speaking from my own point of view, Peter, not on behalf of anyone, that any self-respecting party or organization can endure. And unless there's a fundamental reset of the relationship, and the bona fide concerns, objections, problems, issues of the DA and their constituency are taken into account, I don't think that this GNU can survive in even the medium term unless there are different terms of trade within it. And that's just a view I have. I might be wrong, but that's my thinking.
And
we also were told that Cyril and John had a sit-down last week, and that improvements in the relationship bilaterally, not just personally, will be in the offing. Well, we haven't seen that yet, but it's very early days.
We wait and see, and the president goes off and thinks about it, presumably, before coming back to pronounce one way or another. So what happens now? I mean, Trump is extremely volatile. He pulled his tariff actions against Mexico and Canada, after, for very little obvious gain for the Americans. I mean, both seem to have said we are doing X and Y, which is what they were doing anyway, which he's taken as a sort of, which he seems to have taken as a victory. And depending on what side of the argument you sit, you can take it as a Trump, you know, bossing the world, or Trump setting up conflicts and then declaring himself the winner on the bit of sort of flimsiest of action. But he's wild. I mean, he seems to think U.S. aid sent $100 million worth of condoms to Hamas.
Complete nonsense. Someone worked out
in Gaza. And it turns out that, in fact, the U.S. aid has been sending prophylactics of some kind to Gaza, but to the Gaza province in the south of Mozambique, where they run an aid program. Anyway, Cyril Ramaphosa says he's going to not going to confront Trump. He's going to educate him. I mean, what does he do? Apparently, he's had one call today with Elon Musk. We don't know how that would have gone, but Musk has been very supportive of Trump on his South Africa tweets, and the many people who've come on and supported Trump have been given thumbs up and yes, well done, yeah, you know, true from Musk. So it's hard to imagine Cyril would have made much progress with Musk.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot in what you've just said. First of all, I was really struck, and they are the absolute bellwether of what you might call mainstream conservative opinion, by the editorial this morning in the Wall Street Journal. Now, obviously, the Wall Street Journal is very anti-tariff because they are, in the true best conservative sense, free traders, which Trump is not. And they said, I thought it was very well put, President Trump never admits a mistake, but he often changes his mind. That's the best way to read his decision Monday to pause his 25% tariffs against Mexico and Canada. And then it goes on to say, the 25% border tax, which is actually what a tariff is, as they accurately describe it, could return in a month if Mr. Trump is in the wrong mood or if he doesn't like something the foreign leaders have said or done. Trump has opened a new era of economic policy uncertainty that won't calm down until the president does, unquote. Now, I think in those two paras, Peter, you've got an absolute dipstick correct analysis of Trump Mark II. So he's very unpredictable. He says wild things. He changes his mind, doesn't admit a mistake. And it really is almost like a case of, you know, dyspepsia. If he's in a bad mood, he'll do something or say something, and you never know. So I think, you know, using that as the lens through which to view his remarks about South Africa, both on social media and indeed at the foot of his presidential plane about the horrible things that are happening here, to quote him. I think you've got to say, I don't think he'll give it more attention, but he might in a month or two. And he might come back with a whole raft of things that will be very disagreeable to this country, or he won't. So, you know, it's just, he is brutal, he's transactional, and he's wholly unpredictable. Those are probably the three best or worst adjectives to apply to him. And of course, he is consequential. Look, the Musk tweet, in my view, is far more problematic for South Africa than the Trump tweet. Why do I say that? Because I think it is quite easy, to the extent that facts matter at all. And you know, maybe they don't.
So what did Musk tweet?
Well, I mean, Musk said so yesterday in response, so Cyril's response was, you know, to explain the country respects the rule of law, we don't go in for arbitrary confiscations. And Musk's immediate response on the 3rd of February yesterday is, why do you have openly racist ownership laws? And of course, there was no response, well, in public, I don't know what he said to him in private, from Cyril Ramaphosa to Musk on that. He defended the land grab, but he didn't defend that part. And here's the thing. I mean, we know, Peter, and you've highlighted it many times in your writings and on your podcasts, that we have this whole Starlink saga where our neighbors have quite correctly and appropriately to give digital access and internet access to all their folk, a lot of them in the rural areas, Botswana, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe, have taken Starlink, got all the cheap broadband access, empowered their citizens across their countries. We haven't, because we demand a 30% either equity swap or divestment by Starlink or Musk of his company in order to meet local BEE prescriptions. And that's what's holding this up and has held it up. And that's why a lot of people do not have access to the internet on an affordable basis in this country. So you've got to say, here's the thing. South Africa kind of, you know, to quote Boris Johnson, is pro having cake and pro eating it. So it wants to keep all the racial redress prescriptions and percentages, but it also wants investment, it wants cheap internet, it wants a lot of things. So I don't know whether how that's going to be resolved, but that to me is the sharp end of what Elon Musk was actually in his tweet. I think Trump's tweet, a lot of Trump's tweet was noise. I don't think it's supported by the fact. Some of it might be, but most of it isn't. Musk's line is entirely correct. Why do you have openly racist ownership laws? Now, you can tell it's about redress, it's about the past, it's about reparations, but they are openly racist ownership laws.
But what's so interesting about that tweet, Tony, is that Cyril had a meeting with Musk in New York, I think at the UN General Assembly towards the end of last year, which set off this lots of speculation and confident speculation that a deal was about to be done where we would find some sort of equity equivalent for this 30% and Starlink would soon be available in South Africa. Nobody in the presidency ever did anything to dampen that that speculation. But, you know, reading what you've just read out as Musk's tweet on Monday, he hasn't moved an inch. He's still pissed off that he has to part with a cent. I mean, he didn't become the wealthiest man on earth by throwing money after good money after things he can't control.
Even the equity equivalent. I mean, frankly, and I'm not talking about the virtue of it, and I'm not talking about the past being compensated for in current times. Why would any foreign company come into a country when it's got, you know, the whole world on its menu card and say, well, okay, but you've got to actually fund the equivalent of 30% of your equity to meet one or another local program. Now, you know, once again, let's go back to the beginning. Mr. Trump bestrides the largest of extraordinarily growing economy in the world. I think it's, you know, GDP has gone up twice the size of Europe in the last 10 years. America's just this mighty engine. Might all, you know, seize up in the next few months, but who knows? He actually can be as rude and transactional and as awful, if you like, as he wishes to be, because he's got this huge bazooka, Peter. I'm not disparaging South Africa. South Africa's got a tiny economy by comparison. We are less than 1% of global GDP. We are only country number 36 in the world. And that's the reality. People get very offended because, oh, you're talking down the country. It's not talking up or down. Those are the facts. Yeah. Those are the statistics. And I'll tell you what really concerned me. Strange enough, long before this Trump Twitter meltdown on Monday, Peter, I logged into the United States State Department. And they have, you know, every coming and going of the new Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. And I saw in his first week in office that he had called, and I even counted them out, 39 heads of government or foreign ministers in the world to talk about bilateral matters. I also took notes, and it's on the website, that six of these states were in Africa: Kenya, Morocco, DRC, Algeria, Egypt, and Rwanda. South Africa didn't make the cut. So just in terms of priorities of this new American administration, never mind what Trump says on Twitter, we are less important, in their view, than 40 other countries or 39 other countries in the world. And that's a reality check. And either we up our game or change the rules of some of our game here to meet those conditions, or we will just slide, I think, into a situation of increased marginalization, which is almost unimaginable, you know, because I was, you were an editor, I was an MP. In 1994, we were actually the center of the world. Now, you can only, you know, Andy Warhol said everyone's entitled to be famous for 15 minutes, but we really had the ear of the global community, and we have received, excuse me, ever further and further away from the front of the state.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I don't think, you know, there's any question that policy is not working, the BE policy. In terms of, look, there are two ways in which it doesn't work or does work. As a tool for attracting foreign fixed investment, it's useless, absolutely hopeless. And unless they create a way for foreign investment to get around that, there aren't going to be any. Not at the sort of scale that we have. On the other hand, I suppose you could argue that it's done something to transform the ownership of local companies by including on, you know, the banks and the big construction companies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
If you required this compulsive mechanism to do so, because I just think the market, if you look, I'm a free marketeer.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the market would have forced any serious South African company to transform its ownership, management,
and I'm pretty sure,
work personnel, simply because, you know, the majority of the market in this country is flak, and if you offend or don't treat your customers properly,
No, absolutely, absolutely. But so somebody's feeding Trump all this stuff about South Africa. He doesn't know. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't read. He looks at pictures. If you listen to, well, if you know, I mean, Anthony Scaramucci worked for him for, you know, more than a week. He knows Trump quite well. He understands how he learns, gets information. Who's feeding? You know, AfriForum gets a lot of stick because it did send, there were a lot of people going to the States and they were meeting with, you know, this caucus and that caucus and sort of on the fringes, et cetera, et cetera. But there are also a lot of South Africans around Trump, aren't there? I mean, you know, not just Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, a couple of the sort of, you know, tech billionaires.
David Sachs. David Sachs, exactly. Who I've never heard of, is this cryptocurrency czar and is in that circle. Roelof Botha, who's the grandson of the more famous Puk, although apparently not political, is exceptionally close to Elon Musk. So you've got a whole, about the Stellenbosch mafia, you've got a South African silicone mafia.
Yeah,
that surrounds Trump and his chief whisperer, Elon Musk. So I guess it comes from somewhere that.
But there's another name that's popped up in the last couple of days, a chap called Joel Pollack, who you know, because he used to work for you.
Yes.
And people are now mentioning him as a possible Trump ambassador to South Africa. I don't know whether Trump has even begun to think about posting, you know, he's farmed out a couple of nice embassies like Paris to family members. What he's going to do about South Africa and, you know, Kazakhstan and Pakistan, et cetera, is another thing. But Joel Pollack is a MAGA insider. He works, he's as editor at large at Breitbart News. You will have seen quite a long interview with him today with Carol Payton. He worked in your private office, I think, when you were leader of the DA. What can you tell us? What's he like? What do we know? Is he a smart guy?
He's very smart. Look, Joel worked for me as my speechwriter, my chief speechwriter, but for 4 years, from about 2001 until 2005, 2006, in that period. My chief contribution to his life, times, and happiness is I was the inadvertent Cupid, because also working in my office as an intern was Julia Bertelsmann, daughter of the famous late Rhoda Kadali. And they met, you know, in my office. And they got married.
They had a meeting. Did they have a meeting in your office, Tony?
No, it was all very innocent stuff, of course.
I remember this. I remember years ago the FT describing the deputy governor of the Bank of England and the Bank of England's governor's secretary having meetings in the governor's office.
No. There was nothing inappropriate, and they met. They had a long relationship, and they are now very happily married. They got 4 children.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing about Joel is we just corresponded, not about this. His house was one of the very few. He lives in the Pacific Palisades neighborhood of Los Angeles. The entire neighborhood burnt down, and his house remained standing. Although that's no. Not so nice when your whole neighborhood is burnt down. What can I say about Joel? Joel is extremely intelligent. He is unusually articulate. I mean, there are people very well spoken, write very well. You know, he is in his own league of articulacy. His politics have changed over the years. I mean, Joel was pretty mainstream, liberal, social democrat when he worked for me. He's, you know, migrated, as you mentioned, to the MAGA Republican world, and you know, people are evolve and change, and so there he is. But he certainly is an insider in the circles of influence around Trump. He's editor at large of Breitbart News, which of course was founded by Steve Bannon, who's a huge influencer in that world. He's written a lot of very trenchant, whether you agree with him or not, defenses of Trump and MAGA. And I would imagine that he, and arguably his wife as well, who's a very smart economist, you know, do have some roles to play in the new administration. What they'll be, I do not know. But he's very bright. And look, he's got very definite views, and he's vehemently opposed to South Africa's foreign policy. This is not a result of, you know, private conversations I've had. It's what he's written in the public record as recently as Friday, when I just this is not relevant to Joel, but to the American administration. I mean, Ibrahim Rasool goes to Washington, says, time to put away the megaphone over Israel and Gaza. Sounds like a good idea.
Bit late.
And on Friday, South Africa joins with a sort of ragtag group of countries, all hated by Trump and vice versa, such as Bolivia, Honduras, Belize, Cuba, to start something called the Hague Group, as in the International Court of Justice, to put more pressure on Israel and demand an arms embargo. Now, you know, on the same day that, well, not the same day, within the 3 days that Trump is meeting his first foreign guest, the Prime Minister of Israel, South Africa wants to recover its mojo in Washington. Why would you do that? I don't know. Anyway, Joel Pollack described it as the founding of a group based on, what did he call it? He said it was South Africa's located itself a world where it wants to oppose Israel and support terror. So, you know, certainly, I don't know what his role is going to be in the administration, but he certainly will be more confrontational than the previous ambassador or the one before that on issues like that.
Yeah. Well, God help Ibrahim Rasool. So he tells Carol Payton, this is Joel Pollack in this interview, Trump is going to play hardball, he says. South Africa has adopted a set of economic and foreign policies that are at odds with Western norms, and he wants to see these policies change. For instance, black economic empowerment is a huge problem for investors. In this country, businesses and governments are unraveling race-based policies. Trump ran on getting rid of these policies and received a record share of the vote from racial minorities. There is no appetite in the U.S. for racial policies in investment or anywhere else, he says. Now, there's a lot in there that, you know, is a bit weird as a South African. It surely, it doesn't matter whether you're at odds with Western norms or values. I mean, you can, you know, India is also at odds with Western norms and values, and Indonesia probably is too. Japan probably is too. I mean, it's not as if, you know, so we're a special case in all, amongst all of the people that might be at odds with Western norms, South Africa's at odds in a very particular way. And not an easy way to change, I don't think.
You know, 20 years ago, Joel Pollack's job in life was to present me to the world, and now I've got to interpret him to the world, and I'm not sure I'm best placed to do that, despite my personal linkages with him. But I would hazard a guess that Joel would be quite happy to come on your show.
I hope I can ask you for his phone number, because it would be really interesting to talk to him. Are you in regular touch with him, Tony?
Well, we are in touch from time to time, you know, high days, holidays, family events. But I was in touch very recently with him, but that wasn't occasioned by this, because I didn't know. It was about the fire, and we had a very, I wouldn't say warm exchange. This was about a fire. And I asked him whether, because of the Trump's ascendancy again, whether he would have a role in the administration, and he was suitably diplomatic about that. So I simply don't know.
Yeah.
But I would be in touch with him from time to time, but I obviously don't know his political direction. That's beyond my compass.
I mean, if you were Cyril, right? You're the president of South Africa. You are running a, you know, still proud nation and not insignificant economy. 34 is not as where we should be, but nonetheless, there are smaller ones around. How do you take something like that? I mean, do you simply brush it away as being as part of the cut and thrust of foreign affairs, or do you have some right to take offense at particularly the bit about Western norms? I was a bit uncomfortable with that. I mean, I perfectly understand what he's saying, you know, and let's not make any, let's not be in any doubt that the ANC has completely wrecked this economy. But it's still South Africa.
Oh, sorry, are you asking about Joel Pollack's remarks? Or
yeah, yeah. Or well, I mean that kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, be it Musk or be it, you know, these guys are not. They don't have to. It's completely painless for them to do what they're doing.
Of course,
to say what they're saying.
And their real time conscious. Look, if I was sitting in President Ramaphosa's or behind his desk.
Yeah,
which I tried to get that job for a few years, and you do notice electorally I was unsuccessful in obtaining it. So I must admit defeat. But if I were there today, I would box smart. I think that's the best advice. You've got to say, well, okay, you know, I thought his response yesterday was fine. I mean, it was evasive on the issue Musk raised, but he. You know, like a good lawyer, you put your best case forward. He dealt with that.
Yeah.
He was completely undercut by Gwede Mantashe's rave at the mining in Durban.
Isn't that just stupid?
Threatening to withhold minerals from the United States.
Oh, my God.
I looked it up, Peter. It's our ninth biggest market for mineral exports, the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, I mean, and then he says, oh, well, Africa. We no longer speak for Africa. You might have noticed the phone call last week between Kagame and Rwanda and us. You might have seen the terrible situation with our troops in the eastern DRC. We don't speak for Africa. We don't speak for Kenya. We don't speak for Zambia. We don't speak for Nigeria. They will carry on exporting to the U.S. whatever Gwede Mantashe wants to not do. So he lands up putting South Africa in it, basically a stupid situation. So I think
ridiculous.
That's boxing stupid. I think boxing smart is you say, okay, where are we vulnerable? And what are the areas of our vulnerability? Obviously, our vulnerability is the nature of our export profile, which is still very mineral concentrated. It's the nature of our dependence on the kindness of bond buyers to prop up our debt, which is, as you know, over 5 trillion rand.
Yeah.
And it is also on volatility in our currency rate. Those are just three of many. And the absence of growth, you know, crowns us all and is both cause and effect of all this. So what can I do to start addressing that? You won't make yourself bulletproof, but you make yourself less vulnerable. And then, I don't need to bore you. I wrote a column about how the South African government doesn't have a growth strategy. You've been writing about it for years. I just, joined the dots, to quote the late Pravin Gordhan. And I suggested that you can't have everything. If you pro-growth, you've got to be pro some hard choices. These are the choices. You write about it every week. Yeah. And I don't think they listen to you or read you. They probably read you. I don't think they certainly don't listen or read me, but it doesn't prevent me from pointing out the obvious.
Yeah.
And so unless there's some hard attention given to that, we're going to be more, not less vulnerable to the moment when, I hope it doesn't happen, Trump turns his, you know, one could say his rants, into hard actions. I hope it doesn't happen, but you've got to try and build up your invulnerability or lessen your vulnerability.
Yeah. So, Tony, lastly, and I know you've got places to be, looking at Joel Pollack's interview with Carol Payton, it kind of really felt like a turning point in our ties with America. I mean, whatever the end of this spat might be, the fact is that it's going to be different. You know, 4 years down the line, we will have a different relationship and not a better one with the United States, unless Ramaphosa is able to completely turn around what looks like a very bleak situation. Is there any way out for us and Trump?
Well, look, I don't even if Joel does become, I don't know whether he'll be the ambassador, whoever Trump sends here will be likely to, you know, echo his views or Marco Rubio's views. I don't think there's going to be some kind of silver bullet you can fire and say, well, if we do this, all will be well. I think you're correct. It's going to be a very different environment. It's not an environment which operates in a vacuum. What no environment does, obviously. So what I'm saying is the more, if you like, anti-transformation that Trump is and the pillars of what amounts to ANC transformational policy with all its excesses and problems, the more anti he becomes, I think the greater the pushback is going to be from a lot of those folk inside the ANC and the EFF and the MK to go in the other direction. But you know, once again, it's a game of chicken, because it's all very well to push back against America and say we don't need them, or Gwedi Mantashe, go and keep stick it your minerals, we won't send you or sell you any. You've got to say, do we have a market that's immediately going to replace America? Do we have someone who can send 400 billion rand, I think, is the amount of annual PEPFAR and other aids coming into this country? Who's going to pick up the slack? Well, you know, no one. So there's going to be a bigger gaping hole in the center of our economy, in the center of our NGO community, in the center of our HIV/AIDS fight. And I think it's just going to be difficult. But I think, just to reference not just the Joel Pollack interview, which I think is important, but the beginning of our conversation, I think what's also over is the idea that, well, South Africa will get a free pass. You know, it was apartheid, and Mandela was fantastic, and at least they're more democratic than a lot of the neighborhood they're in. So, and that essentially was the Biden administration's policy.
But
And we've got to propitiate them, and we've got the Black Congressional Caucus to worry about in the U.S. That was probably the most effective lobbying South Africa did during Rasool I in Washington was the Black Congressional Caucus. Well, politically speaking, they're irrelevant now because the Democrats don't have a majority, and whatever they say or think is not going to change a line of legislation. So, yeah, I think those are the new realities. I think what you're hearing out of Washington, what you're hearing from Joel in California, is an echo of that new reality. And, you know, at the risk of repeating myself, you've just got to be adaptive and take it into account and condition your actions accordingly.
Yeah. Tony, thank you very much for joining me. I really do appreciate it. I know you've got places to be. And thank you for listening. Podcast from the Edge. We'll resume normal weekly service next week. Until then, bye-bye and keep safe.